history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories that need to be told. There are men and women around us who have done extraordinary things for the sake of our freedom, and we don't want to forget that. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories, and in that process, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I know that'll be the case today in Madera, California, home for the last 28 years for Pascual Reyes, or as his wife Ramona and friends call him, Pesco. I thought that was a pasta sauce or something, huh?
No.
Or somebody who likes fish.
No.
How long have they been calling you Pesco?
Since a long time, way back when I was young.
And you're the oldest of six children growing up in Los Angeles before World War II. Something tells me L.A. was a little different back then. What do you remember about your childhood in Southern California?
I had my grandfather and grandmother. They were still living, and my aunts and my uncles. So I was very happy there in L.A. for a while. Until I wanted to move out of there and come up north. And her mother was here, living here in Madera, and her aunt and her other relative, and we came up here. I liked it. I liked it right away. And it had been a beautiful place to live, you know. At that time, it was nice and quiet, serene, very, very low profile of people around here. When we moved here, you only had a few houses.
Well, and I think anybody who drives down your block probably notices something about your house. I think your flag flies higher than anybody else on the block. Why do you have that Stars and Stripes flying so high out front?
Remind everybody that I'm a veteran, and we fought for my country. And I want the people to pass through. And they stare at it. They slow down and look at the flag to know that we have the freedom in this country. A lot of people just take it for granted, and not me. I want to show the people that that flag that's flying, was fought for the freedom that we have today. And a lot of guys went out and gave their lives for that. And I wanted to be reminded and be reminded myself, but I want the people to know that.
You talk about that people have fought and died for our freedom. Now, you understand that from multiple perspectives. You've had to live without freedom as a prisoner of war. Your son was killed in action in Vietnam.
Yes.
I imagine few people understand the price of freedom better than you do.
Yes, because like I said, you know, freedom is not just given to you. You have to fight for it and live with it and let everybody know what freedom means, the freedom that you get. You fight for it, and you keep it in your country. Don't let up with our defenses all the time, because there's a lot of people in different countries that want to hurt our country. So that's why we keep our defenses up all the time.
And we're going to hear about your time as a prisoner of war and the things that happened before and after that. But I want to hear about your childhood, because I'm just trying to picture being a young boy in East L.A., late 20s through the 30s. Do you remember having some big ideas, some dreams and hopes and ambitions about what you were going to do when you grew up?
Well, at that time, I wanted to be a ranger, be on the outside. That's what I wanted to be. I actually, because I was in the CC camps, I was up there in the forest, up there in the mountains. And oh, I used to like that, you know, the smell of the trees and all that in the morning, you know. We had barracks like a regular army. Man, that was beautiful, being there, you know. And I wanted to be that. I wanted to be a ranger. But I had been in the CC camps, you know. And I said, I'm going to be a ranger. But it never happened, you know.
Well, some other things changed around the world that interrupted your plans there. But a lot of people don't know about the Civilian Conservation Corps and these camps where youngsters like you, teenagers, were out there working and saving money. And it probably prepared you for the military too, huh?
Oh, yes. We had a regular army captain that was a commander of the... He was retired, but he still dressed as a army captain. And he had command of the camp. He had people there show us how to use a coal or a pig for the fires. And he was very, very interested the way we fought the fires.
So you guys are fighting forest fires. Where was this? Was this around here somewhere or down south?
Around here. All these big mountains.
All through the Sierra Nevada. You guys were fighting fires and working on projects.
Yeah. But this time, this fire that broke out started going up in the trees, you know, from one tree to another. So some guys got hurt. So they took us off the firefighting and let the regular rangers do the fireman.
And how old were you when you were in the CC camps?
At that time, I was about 16, 17 years old. I was young guy, real young.
So not a long time before Pearl Harbor happened. What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Do you remember how you found out what happened?
Well, it was up in the radios. We didn't have no TV then. It was just in the radios, and it was scary. We were young, but we still felt that, you know, we understood that our boats that were sunk and all that was very bad, real terrible.
So you're 18 years old when that happens. Yeah. You hear about this on the radio. Did you think that you were going to be involved in this somehow?
Well, I didn't. It never hit my head. But then, you know, when they started in Germany, and I figured out by the years, I said, I think I'm going to be going for sure, you know. And I sure did, because in time, they drafted me. I went into the L.A. We got sworn in. You know, Patton, he had a place there close to where we were, and he had a big house. That's where Patton came up from, close to where I used to live. I had a wife already, you know. I never got to see my kid get born. When I left, my wife left me, you know.
So when you went overseas, she was pregnant?
Yeah.
And your first child was born while you were gone?
Yeah.
But by the time you came back, she had moved on?
She had moved on. I never blame her. Of course, you know, she was young and I was young, you know. So I knew she wasn't going to be waiting for me, you know.
So was it easy to adjust to life in the Army early on, or was that kind of a shock to your system?
Well, when I got into the Army, I was very curious about what would come next, you know. So it didn't bother me that much. You know, I used to that, especially the clunkers they gave me for shoes. You know, I would get blisters and all that like everybody. I finally got adjusted. And in fact, I liked it a lot, you know. I used to like to march, adjusted one way or another, running and exercise. I like to exercise. I felt myself gaining a little more weight and being more stronger, more alert for everything. I liked it. I really got adjusted to the Army. I don't know how, but I really got adjusted.
And you ended up in the 36th Infantry Division.
Oh, yes.
What was that like? What were the other guys like, and how did they treat you?
At first, you know, we were like strangers to each other, because all of them that were from different, you know, environment, whatever. They were from the same place. Some of these guys came from being neighbors and all that. They're in Texas. But after that, you know, they got adjusted. I had a good sergeant, a Mexican sergeant. I liked him a lot, you know, and he was a very understanding person. Any problems I had, I would go to him, and he would fix it or do something for it. And, you know, I didn't see my kid, like I said, but I told him if they could send a message to my kid, and they did. It was okay. I took orders, and I enjoyed those, you know.
And you ended up in a rifle platoon or what?
Rifle platoon. I was in the 3rd squad. I enjoy it. I like, you know, marching around and all that. And I knew I had my rifle and my bayonet, my canteen, my belt, heavy belt that I have more ammunition, more clips, you know.
How did you feel about the idea of going overseas and fighting this enemy and risking your life? Were you nervous about that? Were you unsure of what it was going to be?
It still didn't hit my head that much, you know. But I know that I was going to be in danger. That's You know, you see your rifle and ammunition, and you hear, you know, you're going to go fight the enemy. And I figure, well, hell, you know, we're going to have rifles and ammunition. There's something else. This is not cops and robbers. No, man, when I got over there and we made the invasion, I had those bandoliers like Pancho Villa, you know. When we got off the invasion, I had to take those things. I was smart. I took those things off. We were still had to walk all the way up to the beach. So I took those things off and left enough ammunition in my belt because some of the guys got drowned.
Yeah, it's heavy. That could weigh you down. So, and the invasion you're talking about is North Africa?
Yeah.
What did you see and experience when you came ashore?
Well, I didn't do a heavy fighting there. Like I say, we just waded to the ground.
Waded through some shallow water onto the beach with no opposition at that point.
They did that just for us to get a sense of it. But in Italy, we did get off. Oh, that was hard. I mean, you see the guys not being knocked off, you know, by the machine guns. Those Germans put those crossfire, a lot of crossfire, a lot of bunkers. But, you know, our ships were knocking those bunkers. You should see, you know, they were shooting those destroyers. They came close. And you could see the bunkers just fly up in the air. A lot of Germans in there. Well, they held us there in the beachhead for I don't know how long. There were a lot of guys being knocked off. So the sergeant said, we have to get off the beach, you know. They're knocking us, a lot of us. If we're going to have to die, we might as well die getting those bunkers and breaking them through. So we did. We got in between the bunkers and got it up in the back and threw grenades into the bunker. And a lot of those Germans started coming out. A lot of Germans died. But all the line moved up. Like I said, some of the guys got knocked off. But we took all the bunkers and chased those Germans to Kane. And then we got up there. By that time, the paratroopers had landed in the back. We met with the paratroopers. We did pretty good that the other day. I think we marched about 15 miles inland and met with the paratroopers. We did a lot of fighting. All the way fighting. House fighting, street fighting, you name it. We did it.
Well, I'm sure there's plenty of close calls contained in all of that. But before I move on from North Africa, there aren't too many people alive anymore who fought in North Africa.
Oh, no.
I mean, that was the earliest action that America had in that part of the war. What was that like? What was the fighting in North Africa like?
It was kind of hard because you fight in those sand dunes and all that, you know. You're going straight in the ground, and sometimes you would go down, and you would never think there's a hole there. And then the mines. How the heck are you going to see a mine until they came around with that thing, you know? And you would be stopped, and you would be a target. You know, those Germans were very smart the way they planned it. Those mines, plus they had those defense lines. But we got into it, you know. They had us right in the open. They had tanks right across, a lot of tanks. And they could shoot, knock the heck out of us.
Well, that brings up a lot of questions in my mind. When you talk about these minefields, and either you're risking it by going through them and not knowing when one's going to go off,
right,
or you know they're out there so you can't move, and then you're a sitting duck for them to shoot you. So did you experience witnessing or hearing other guys being blown up by mines?
We seen them. I seen them with my own eyes. You fight like that, what you do, you go behind the tank so you can be protected by smoke and fire or whatever it is. He's going to hit the tank first. So you have to get behind the tank. And you could see some other guy would go around it, hit a mine. He would be blown up. You know, and when you see a human being blown up, it's very, very terrible. We never say nothing about that, but I'm saying that right now. You see the blood and guts, and because they had two kinds of mine, one in the ground and the other one that jumping ready, what they call it. It comes up to a certain height, then it'll explode. So, you know, you can imagine what was left of a human being, of a soldier, nothing, just a bunch of blood and skin.
And you're just a young kid. You're half a world away from your family, and then you're seeing stuff like this.
Yeah.
I mean, how does that make you feel? Do you think you're going to be next?
No, I never thought about that. What I did was get more experience and take care of myself the way I walk in different places and be sure that the moment anything happened, to go flat on my stomach. You know, some of the guys didn't know, what are you doing that for? But for me, I knew what I was doing, exactly what I was doing. You know, that way I took care of myself. That's the way I fought all the way up in Africa.
Do you remember the first time you had to deal with losing someone you had gotten to know?
Yes. In that part of Africa, we lost a guy. You know, and it was only a replacement. We were in a regular division yet. But then when they put us in a regular division, of course, you know, I seen a lot of the guys. We were in the invasion, you know. You get off those flat boats, you know, and start running towards the beachhead. Those Germans got all those crossfire machine guns, like I say, you know. And then they put those mines in high water, in high tide. And some of the guys, you know, would step on them. A lot of them. A lot of guys were hung up on the wires and all that. But I didn't have time to keep looking back, you know, or trying to help a friend of mine. They could call out, but they were, you know, they were all dead. You could see, you know, their bodies all open.
How do you keep going in circumstances like that? How did you deal with what was happening around you and the death and destruction and tragedy and not just go crazy?
Well, in the first place, you ask God to help you. Little Lord, help me to go with all this, you know. I don't want, you know, I lost just friends, and just keep me going, keep me free from being hurt. And that I kept on going. I had faith. And guys, you know, don't believe in that. Some of them say, what the hell are you doing? You know, I knew what I was doing. And I did that all the way. All the way, you know, even when I got captured. But it never stopped me from doing my duty, what I was there for. If I had to shoot a German, I would do it. But I didn't freeze or, you know, some guys will freeze. I'll tell you, they'll freeze and they get sick after they see all that around them. But not me. I got a really cold. I had like a chip on my shoulder, anger, because I seen all my friends, some of them get killed. I got like a revenge or a chip on my shoulder. I want to do the same thing to them. And that's what kept me going.
And he kept going and going and going with the 36th Infantry Division, North Africa, Italy, on into France, and then into captivity. It's a pretty amazing story this former prisoner of war can tell. Time for our first break. But don't forget to go over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and video relating to Mr. Reyes and his story. And we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 94-year-old Pascual Reyes of Madera, California, originally from East Los Angeles. He is an ex-prisoner of war and Purple Heart recipient from the 36th Infantry Division in World War II. You might recognize that division as the one whose men became the Lost Battalion, cut off but then rescued because of the heroics of the Japanese-American soldiers of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. Mr. Reyes was captured before all of that happened. We're going to hear about his capture, but before we left off, he shared how he prayed for God to protect him. I know, though, that having your faith coexist with the unfathomable things happening around you was something that you really struggled with at times.
When we were in France, I didn't want to go into the mass hall because, you know, the padre was giving a mass, you know, to everybody. And I didn't want to go in there. This chaplain asked me, he was sitting outside. He said, "What's wrong now?" I said, "I don't want to go in there because right now I go in there and we pray and all that. Then I come out and go and kill Germans." I said, "And I get confused." This chaplain was outside, you know. He said, "This is what the Lord said for you?" "No. The Lord didn't send me here. My government sent me here. You know, I'll do my duty, but I don't want to go into church. I get all mixed up, so I don't want to go in there." He said, "All right. But wherever you are, you can say your prayers by yourself or whatever, but you can say it by yourself. That, Lord, we will hear you. You don't have to go to mass. You can do it by yourself." And that's the way I went. When I was in a tight spot, which I was, I would ask the Lord to help me. "Please help me. I haven't got no out." It's like he said, "You can't. You can't do it." And I would curl and get the hell out of the place where I was, because they would be putting mortars in that spot, and some of the guys got it, you know.
Can you give us a taste of that? How close some of these instances were? I mean, how close these enemy mortar shells are coming to you, or bullets? What are the closest calls that you remember?
I went in a patrol down to the valley, because we were up here. I went down to... there was a building there. There had been a tank in there shooting. And we knew there was a tank, but we weren't too sure. We didn't want to kill people. So some guys and me, we were sent down the valley to find this tank in there. And we got into a firefight with the Germans there. Some guy got mistaken and started shooting down where we were.
One of your own guys?
Yeah. So they pulled us back. They told us, "Get the hell out of there and come on back." So we come on back. But that time there was dike. Anyway, I'm going to tell you, before we got into that mountain, you know where we were right there? It was a minefield. And these two guys, these two rangers, marked it. They went in there and they marked it, that minefield. And then we attacked it and we went one by one across that minefield. A big, long minefield, I can remember. We got out of there.
So you're walking this very narrow path that these rangers had marked, the only safe way through.
Yeah. When we got up there, this guy and me, they sent us to different positions. So we got up to that position where we were supposed to be. They told us, "You guys get in there where the Germans had been before." So we were supposed to be two. And I told that guy, "Who the hell is that? This is other guy. There's three of us. We're supposed to be two." I said, "I don't know. Ask him what division he is." "God damn, he was a German." "That scared the heck out of me. Man, I said, how could I miss it? You know, he was a German." He said he stayed behind because he wanted to give up. So we set him down. Oh, man, he scared the heck out of me. Oh, man, I couldn't talk. My mouth got dry. But he was, no, he didn't do nothing. But that's the most scared piece in my mind. Oh, I said, "I got it now." No, I was okay. Yeah. Another time, I was with a captain. A motor round hit the top. He was knocked out. So the lieutenant had to take over. And I didn't get hurt. But I took a dive right away. I ran over and took a dive. There was a canal, empty, like a river or whatever. And all the guys were mashed up in there. I got in there. And they started throwing mortars, but they were hitting the building. And the captain was wounded in there. So some of the guys went out and took him out and took him in the canal with us. But it was really close as those guys shooting those mortars.
And I know there's really no end to your close calls, but walk me through what it was like to make this landing in Salerno, Italy. You mentioned how the German defenses had entry points on the beach zeroed in from multiple firing locations. This is September 1943. You'd be spending the better part of the next year fighting in Italy. But what was that invasion like, and what kind of opposition were you up against as you came ashore?
Everything, even the big guns, and they were all heavy artillery. And I got off right in town, so I had a little cover from the buildings. I remember this guy came right up to the, almost up like a pier, and we got off there. They got the heck out of there. But the rest of the guys got a little on the other side.
So what's happening around you as you're coming in?
Oh, a lot of artillery, a lot of machine gun bullets coming. They had a 50-caliber heavy gun shooting, and they were just going through some of the boats. You know, they were made of wood, and they would just cut right through it.
So they were hitting the boats as they're approaching the shore.
They were going down, a lot of the boats. And like I say, you know, I threw my things off.
Yeah, you got rid of your bandoliers so they didn't weigh you down and make you drown. But how close do you think those enemy bullets came to you on that day?
Well, they hit our boat. They hit some of the guys on the side.
On your own boat, really close to you.
Yeah, yeah, see, you get the front, you know, where the ramp opens, yep. Then you go in the back. I was in the front, and, you know, they were shooting. We started going on our stomach, but we couldn't very well. We were one on top of the other. Because we were standing up, that thing was just cutting right through. So, yeah, that was really bad.
So if you stood up in the boat, you're probably going to get killed.
Yeah, oh, yeah. It was bad, yeah, that thing was very bad. Because the machine guns kept going. Once you're in the base, you know, you have to get off. You're either there or you just die there. On account of the mortars, they throw a lot of mortars. Especially the Germans, they like to throw a lot of mortars.
So where'd you go from there? What were those next days and weeks like after you came ashore at Salerno?
We fought and fought until we broke the line, the defense lines they had. They had a lot of defense lines. The 1, 2, 3 defense lines, they could stay there. Until we broke them because American paratroopers jumped in the back and the British, they started coming in, they started helping out, you know. Instead of having all those lines of German defenses, some of them had to turn and face the British and the Americans. But the American paratroopers were just breaking right through them. We started breaking right through ourselves. But those tanks, they had a lot of tanks, but our planes came in, you see. That by that time, a lot of those Stukas had been knocked out. And our American planes were just coming in one after another. And then they started bringing in the B-17s, the heavier bombs. Those bombers throw a lot of bombs. And they throw in those fire bombs. You could see the German line. The whole bunch of lines I seen that coming out of Rome. And you could see the whole line burning. And the airplanes had knocked them all this line. They had been knocked out. We were pretty good.
You say Italy is where you first contracted malaria?
Yeah.
What does that do to you? What does that feel like? What kind of condition did it leave you in?
Oh, boy. I was so sick. We had just gotten off the fighting there in the houses and all that and met the paratroopers. And I was sitting down there drinking a lot of water. Some of the guys went and got me some water in a helmet. I about drank all of it. And then all of a sudden, I just fell off. And I can remember when they had me in a stretcher, in a Jeep, in the fender. They put me there, and I was bumping. I opened my eyes, and I was in a Jeep. And then the next time I opened my eyes, I was in a general hospital there in Italy, and we had a lot of wounded in there. And I woke up next to a friend of mine, this little Italian guy, he was blonde hair. He was from the Bronx, and I told him, you know, I'm going to go back now. I'm going to go back to my outfit. I can't stand being here, and everybody's moving up. So I did. I got a supply truck, and he was going up, and they took me up there, and I did pretty good. I stayed with my division for a while until they captured me. I wasn't scared, but they wanted me to carry this guy, and it was raining, and I couldn't make it. They captured me because we were in two buildings. I was in one building, and they were in the majority of the guys were in this big building. And then to the right was a forest, and to the back of them, there was forest. And I told them, we're going to be down there. You guys start going down. It's going to start raining. It's getting dark, dark. We'll engage the guys, the enemy. We'll engage them for a while. Then we're going to start running back over there that way. About that time, this Jeep comes in, and they were shooting all over. But they didn't get him. He was a captain. We told him to get the hell out to the back, to run over to our forest. We started engaging the enemy. Well, of course, you know, just a little while, somebody in English told us, you Americans better give up now. You haven't got a chance. Plain English, good English. Then he talked to us in Spanish, and he told us, you know, that we didn't have a chance in Spanish. I said, what the hell is this? About that time, a big tank comes, stays over there. So what we did, we gave up. But the rest of the guys had taken off. They escaped. Some of them, but some of them were still captured.
How many were there in the group that you were in that were captured there?
Oh, about, I would say about 5 or 7, something like that.
But you knew you guys were outnumbered and surrounded.
Oh, yeah. With that tank, if we would have done a couple of shots, that tank would have blown us up. I wouldn't be here. So I told the guys, what's up to you? I'll leave it up to you. You want to keep on or you want to give up now? I said, there's no chance. Remember, that tank is up there. See, we haven't got a chance.
Well, and before you got captured, you were wounded. What happened there? Tell me about it.
Well, what happened is that I got wounded, you know, I don't know if it was a bullet or a piece of that stuff. I hit my butt. You know, most of the time you get hit in the butt, and I did. I couldn't walk very much. I couldn't run that much. Then they wanted me to carry a German when I got captured because I couldn't move very much.
Because you got captured not long after you're wounded, yeah. Your left side is still in a lot of pain?
Yeah. They got me real bad, you know, and I couldn't move. I didn't want to shoot because, I couldn't move. I knew that if I shot, I was going to be killed because I couldn't run and hide behind the trees and all that. So, like the German said, just throw your rifle out, it'll be clear.
Well, maybe you can walk us through what it was like from there, because I'm sure you had no idea what to expect when you're going to be a prisoner.
I didn't expect nothing. I knew that I was captured. I didn't know if I was going to be killed because they told us, you know, that be careful because some of these Germans are very handy with their rifles or pistols. And they don't care. They'll knock the hell out of you. But they captured me and they took me to a barn because it started raining. Some of us, they didn't keep us together because we were quite a bit of us, about 200, I think. They had a lot of hate and some of these Germans were resting inside the barn. Why fight it? There's nothing for me to do right now. I went to sleep. In the morning, they marched us to this place, prison place. Before they did that, they interviewed us and all that. He was a mean little guy. You know, always there were like everybody, your name, rank, and serial number. And we stuck with it. And we stuck with it, period. They wanted to know how many divisions or what company and all that. We didn't say nothing. Slapped the hell out of us.
Wait, I want to make sure people hear that. You said they slapped you.
Oh, yes. They slapped us a couple of times. They did that because they were trying to hurt us, to scare us. See, we would talk, see? I knew that. So they sent me to a prison camp where I met the rest of the guys, and they were aviators. And they I talked with this young aviator, and he told me, he said, I was wounded, and my plane came down, and I got hurt. But they took care of me here in the hospital. You'd be imagined, doctors there, German doctors, good doctors that took care of the people. Anyway, we were in that camp, and the nurses would come around in the car, and they would go through the camp. Check everybody out, make everybody stand out. Then they would send out the dogs in there to all the buildings. They were looking for a radio. These guys, these engineers, we picked up what they told us to pick, and they made a radio. And they had it there and right in the kitchen. There was a post there, a wooden post. And I don't know, this guy was very smart. He dug a little thing, and they had that thing in there.
He hollowed out part of the post to hide the radio inside?
Yeah.
And the Germans never found it?
Never found it.
That was your connection to the outside world.
Yeah, we used to hear British broadcasting, and they would tell us exactly how far our people were. So we were just taking it easy in prison. We didn't do nothing to arise the Germans. That's the way we kept it until the people came in, you know.
And we're going to hear about that, too, by the time we're done. Break time again. Pascual Reyes is our guest today. He and his wife, Ramona, have been married for 69 years. And you can find a photo of them at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're going to catch the rest of his remarkable story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 94-year-old former prisoner of war Pascual Reyes of Madera, California. One thing we didn't cover about his time as a prisoner of war was his experience being transported in one of the infamous train cars known as a 40 and 8. It was supposed to fit 40 men or 8 horses. How many prisoners do you think you guys had packed in there?
Oh, I don't know, because he was full. And guys were sick and wounded and whatever, you know. So I got up to the corner of the cart so I could breathe in a little window that had a... Because most of those guys were sick, throwing up and all that. They were very in bad shape. And then our own planes came in straight for us. The train stopped, you know, and they took us off. Our airplanes kept strafing us until they seen all the prisoners. Then they stopped. Then they put us back in the corner in a train. And then we kept going then to the prisons.
When those American planes were strafing, did they kill some of the prisoners?
I suppose so, yeah. I think they did. Yeah, because the train had a lot of prisoners. I'm pretty sure that some of them got hurt in the back. There was a tunnel. We were close to that. Some of us got in there.
You went and hid in the train tunnel?
Yeah, we got in the tunnel, and our guards too. But these planes came around a couple of times, strafing back and forth until they found out, I guess, that they had to lay off, you know. We were prisoners.
What was the hardest thing for you about being a prisoner?
The hardest thing for me to be a prisoner was that I was a prisoner in the first place and I couldn't move. I escaped twice from a work detail, but I didn't know which way to go. So I got into the work detail, going back. Somebody told me which way to go. But then when I went out again from this work detail, this Puerto Rican went with me. I didn't care for it, and nobody to go with me. And this Puerto Rican, he was in a tree, and this kid seen him. And this, so stupid, killed the kid. But by that time, I swung out of there and went back straight off, and he went into the work detail. And I was scared then, because they were all police, and the Germans were all over. They found this guy, they killed him. Oh, I said, no, I ain't going to go out no more. I'm liable to get caught and killed, you know.
So you had been out on a work detail and snuck off by yourself? You're all alone?
Yeah.
But because you didn't know which way to go, when you saw that crew again, you joined back up?
Yeah, I went back. They told me which way to go if I wanted to leave. I said, no, I'm not going to leave no more. You know, I'm not going to take no chances like that. Because they get me, I'll be shot right there.
And you knew that because you saw that happen to him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure.
Was there a time where your family didn't know what had happened to you?
Yes. When I got captured, they didn't know for a long time that I had been captured already.
So they probably thought you were dead.
Yeah. The Red Cross let him know. They went over there to the house and let him know that I had been captured.
So while you were in captivity, which was quite a while, if you look at late September to end of April, a little more than 7 months?
Something like that.
That's a long time when you don't know when it's going to end, right? How did you pass the time? How did you remain hopeful in the midst of that kind of situation?
You wouldn't believe it, but I did exercises. This guy and me would shadow box against a wall and do exercise in place, you know. And all the time, every day we did run push-ups. And that's the way I kept busy.
Did you ever have days where you thought, I might not ever get out of here?
Yes. You're there, you know, and you never know what the Germans could do. If they started losing, I figured that they would shoot us, you know, like they shot the rest of some of those guys. We didn't know, you know, for sure what these Germans would do, you know. If they would get revenge or before they would be captured, I figured they would shoot us. And with those little machine guns, you couldn't escape. I told myself, if there's rifles, I'll take a chance and run the heck out of me. But machine guns, no. No way.
So while you were in the prison camp, you had another bout of malaria?
Yes. I got another heavy malaria. I was sick. I thought I was going to die because I had been, you know, the food wasn't that good. And then you're weak, very weak. There were some British soldiers there, and they kept me going, wetting my lips and giving me a little water because I would get sick if I drink a lot of it, just a little bit. I would feel okay. And I don't know where the hell they found out those Erbine pills or whatever you call them, those yellow pills, and they gave me some. The malaria started easing off. After that, they gave me another two pills, and before I know it, I didn't have no more malaria. And I could drink a little bit more water. That's the way I went, with a little bit more water every day. That's the way I went until I got Patton came in.
Those fellow prisoners of yours, those British guys, they really did save your life.
Yeah, they did. You know, I looked for their names. I wanted to know their names, and I could never find them. Never. I was in Europe one day, you know, and I was in a train, and I was telling these people. He says, that little town, that village is close to us. Do you know their name? We'll take them for you. But they never did, of course, you know. But they saved my life. They gave me those pills. Those headaches went away. See, you get the chills, and then you get the headache. You get those headaches very heavy. Then you get really, really hot. I mean, your body can't stand that.
Have you ever had any recurrences of that in the years since the war?
Only one time when I came back after the service at my house. I was sitting down and all of a sudden I started going like that.
You mentioned until Patton came in. And there's famous photographs of Patton in his Jeep coming through the gate at Mooseburg, Stalag 7A. His son-in-law, I think, had been a prisoner there. But what was that like for you, that experience of having months and months of being a prisoner, not knowing freedom, and then to have these Americans, including one of the most famous Americans in the war, and set you free? Tell me about what that time was like.
You see that thing, the General Patton coming in? You know, he's a rough and a bad mouth, everybody. You know. Oh, man, you see him like... He was the greatest in this world. He said, I would say he was my angel, my guardian angel. And the guy came through that camp, and he said, bring out all those Germans out of here, because the Germans were hiding, you know. They had to come out, all of them. Boy, he went around and cut the hell out of them, and he said, you know, he was going to kill each and every one of them. You know, he said he was bad mouth, you know. He got in his Jeep again, you know. Here we go. But I was so, so happy, like something had been lifted out of my shoulders. That man was tough, but he was a gentle giant. He was what you call a man, a general. They took us to the airport there, close by. There was an airport, you know, it was hidden, you know. You couldn't see it, but it was there. And the American transport planes came around. Boy, they were good flyers. They come around the field, one by one, then another turn, all the planes lined up. Then they took us, they gave us a ride all the way to France. They took us up to the doctors. They had a big building. They had a physical, a shower, a haircut, and I mean that they went through everything in our body. Like I said, they gave us a haircut and a bath, new clothes. Man, I felt like I was a king there. We were back with our people, and they treated us like taps. Then they sent us into the hospital boats, you know, the ones that were going to bring us back. The same thing with those sailors. They had Marines in there and sailors, and they treated us taps. Man, it was good. Good meals all the way, all the steaks you wanted, whatever. But we couldn't eat very much steak. No, on account of stomach. Yeah, we had those shrunken stomach. You had to eat in one line chocolate, all the chocolate you could drink, and eggnog, and that's all. After so many days, they would change you to another line where you could eat a little bit more, a little more heavy. Then you got into a steak line. That was good. When you hit that steak line, that was for it. That was forever.
What was it like to get back to America again after you were a prisoner for so long?
When I see the Liberty of Statue of Liberty, I cried. I actually cried. Not only me, the rest of the guys.
Don't feel pressured to share anything you're not comfortable sharing. But, you know, we have all these honor flights going to Washington, D.C., guys like you to see their memorials for free. You don't want to go.
Well, those are good memorials and all that. I don't know if the guys enjoy that, but not for me. I did my duty. I did what the government wanted me. I fought hard. I live a hard life, and I feel that I won my place in this world as a soldier. Fought for my freedom and the freedom of others and for my country. If I was younger, I would fight for my country again. Freedom flies. I hope the guys enjoy all that. But my freedom is here in my home where I enjoy myself and walk around. I have friends, and they ask me what I was in the army and all that. And they ask me if I was scared. Yes, I was scared. Truthfully, I was scared. There's no doubt about it. But I did what I had to do.
I don't want to misinterpret, so correct me if I'm wrong. But I got the impression that maybe the reason you don't want to go to Washington is that it would be really hard to look at your son's name on that wall?
No, I've been there. I've been to the wall. Yeah. I've been to Washington.
What was it like to see Ronnie's name on that wall?
It cracked me up. I did cry. But then I was very proud of him. Very proud of him. I was real glad that my son is up there in that wall, that people can see that what it means. There were 38 guys killed that day, that same day. So I meet some of those people. We meet, my wife and me, meet some of those people.
The families of the others killed that day.
It kind of eases off your pain when you talk with other people. But we've been there.
What do you want people to know? If they go to that wall and they look up, and there's 58,000 names on that wall, but when they see his name there, what do you want them to remember about him?
I want them to know that my son fought the war like everybody else, you know, the Marines. They were very outstanding people because the way they are shown how to do certain things that the Army doesn't show you. And I'm very proud of him. Even if he's dead, I'm very, very proud of him. And the other kids that did that, that's why. And I want the people to know that those names is a human being that was in this world years back. They're gone, but for a reason, for freedom. For the freedom they want, and for the freedom they have, all everybody. That's what I want them to know.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for your service to our country and for the price that you helped pay for that freedom. Is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, like I said, my son, I want the people to know why those names are there, because they gave their life for the freedom we have today. Not just because they went and fought a war. That's the freedom you have, the freedom we all have. And they shouldn't forget them. They should honor them as much as they can. That's why.
I don't know if anybody can say it any more powerfully than that. Pascual Reyes, an ex-prisoner of war and a Gold Star father, helping us understand once again today on Hometown Heroes that freedom is not free.